The meeting of the Government Operations and Elections Committee will come to order, and we don't have a quorum yet, but to keep on time, I'm going to start with the testimony. And then after we have the Honorable Lippman come up and give us a presentation on rulemaking, I'll have all of the staff and member introductions. That'll give us a chance to wait for the rest of the membership to get here. So with that, are you prepared to proceed, Honorable Judge Lippman?
I am very much, Madam Chairwoman. Thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Chairwoman Peppin, members, my name is Eric Lippman. I'm an administrative law judge from the Minnesota Office of Administrative Hearings. I'd like to speak with you briefly about state rulemaking, a particular charge of this committee. I want to start at the end of the presentation, just so that you'll know what the takeaways are, but we'll have a little bit more detail in the middle. So what every member should know about state rulemaking is that it's an important part of self-government, that for members, the delegation of rulemaking authority, the key concern of this particular committee in this area, these things really matter, and this is something that the rest of the legislature relies upon your special expertise to focus on, that the delegations really matter, and that when rulemaking generally, when the process goes to involve the public, Minnesota has decided through various statutes to rely upon the wisdom of the group. Lastly, the fourth point is that while our rulemaking approach is complicated, it's fairly complex, I'd like to argue today that it yields actually better results than the alternatives. So it's an important part of self-government. The key focus for you is that delegations really matter. We rely upon the wisdom of the group, and while it's complicated, it really does lead substantively a lot better results than the alternatives. And we'll see at the end if I've made my case. On the very first day of session, in fact, I think it's the first vote that you actually made after the election of officers, you passed this rule, 4.13, which suggests that the Committee on Government Operations and Elections, this committee, has jurisdiction over any bill that delegates rulemaking authority or exempts from rulemaking a department or agency of state government. So you are the gatekeeper on administrative rules in this process. It's the people here in this room and likewise the Committee on State Government Innovation in the Senate that everyone else in the legislature and the public at large relies upon to be the experts in this area, and so I'm grateful for the chance that the chair has given me to make a presentation on this. I'd like to step back 200 and some years at the very beginning, why this is important. Mr. Jefferson is there. He's there at his writing desk on Market Street in Philadelphia, and he writes, "We hold these truths to be self-evident," you know the words, "that we're endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights," okay, so an important point, "and that with those rights, governments are instituted among men and women, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed." So at the fundamental core of our democracy is this idea, I will suggest in a moment, what we're doing here in this room and likewise the administrative rule process. So just to do that graphically, we've got the Creator at the left side. He makes, he or she, or the Almighty makes a delegation of rulemaking authority to who?
The voters.
The voters, exactly right. And then they make a delegation. They pick at the ballot certain folks to go to another important room. I think people in this room recognize that other delegation made from the voters. And then the key piece, what we're talking about this morning, is another further delegation to where? What's that other room?
Agency.
State agency. Exactly. It looks like the alphabetocracy that we have, it's an uninspiring grade cube where our 44,000 state employees are dutifully at work in public service. And so we have a series of delegations from heaven all the way down to the agency on Cedar Street. Okay, and this is the process that it goes. Let me just talk briefly about the two different office spaces. We touched on it briefly. Maybe if I could, Madam Chair, ask members if maybe they could identify some of the differences between the two office spaces.
That'd be wonderful.
How are they different? I'll suggest a couple. One is office space A is open. It's on television. It follows from folks with election certificates. It follows from the ballot box, the people who have desks there. Office space B doesn't involve any people standing for election, being held accountable directly to the voters. It's not oftentimes particularly transparent. These people are not well-known. They're not on television in Office of the And so we have very different procedures as far as how we, and the powers that we invest in the people in the various offices. So that's an important point to keep about and to keep in mind. The strings that we attach when there are delegations of rulemaking authority from you here in the legislature to state agencies. There's the public notice process. That's the string that we attach. Again, because these folks aren't subject to election, they're not well-known, they do their work in offices that aren't televised. The detail of the SONAR, which is the Statement of Need and Reasonableness. We'll talk about this in a little bit more detail in a second, but this is the proof that the agency goes through detailing why one or another proposed rules is reasonable and should be adopted. We require that each agency prove this up, an affirmative presentation of the facts. They have to actually establish the reasonableness of each and every rule that they provide, or it doesn't get approved. There's an independent review by OAH, that's our office, the Office of Administrative Hearings, with judges like myself. We go over and make sure that all of the requirements that agencies are supposed to follow under the law are met, or the rule doesn't get approved. That's another important string that's attached. And finally, there's a gubernatorial veto. Even if the agency wanted to, is within its statutory authority, it's approved for reasonableness and propriety and conformance with the statutes. It gets a clean bill of health from OAH. The governor can still veto. Okay, again, another string that the legislature has imposed upon administrative rulemaking. And all of these reasons are because the folks who are doing the drafting aren't subject to election or other forms of accountability. And so we have this process to make sure that they are accountable. The current legislative consensus says that the has a number of purposes, and those are found in 14.001. I'll drill down a little further just by taking the verbs out of these sentences. And the purposes of the APA are for oversight, public accountability, uniformity, public access to the process, and public participation. So when people ask, you know, why do we have such a complicated process in Chapter 14? Why do some members of this committee say, geez, and I did when I was a member of this committee many years ago. I said, well, geez, this is awfully complicated. Surely there has to be a better mousetrap. I think the key understanding that I've come to and that I would argue for today is that we achieve all of these other items by a process that's slightly more complicated than we would have, I think individually might have come up with. And I think that there are some benefits to the complexity because of the kinds of things that we can achieve like this, and I'll make that argument in a moment. The legislature's conclusion, likewise, is found in that same statute. It says, while the APA regards the procedure, the way that we develop administrative rules, we actually believe that going through this process yields better substantive results, that we'll get a better product at the end. And I think that the legislature is correct in that conclusion, that this process, while we focus on the steps and the hoops that one must go through to promulgate a rule, that we actually get better rules as a result. So how do we engage the wisdom of the group? How do we go out and find the best ideas? We begin engaging folks with the SONAR, again, the Statement of Need and Reasonableness. So the agency prepares a statement that makes available to the public detailing each of the reasons that it is advanced in support of a particular rule. And there is an opportunity for a public hearing and for folks to come and submit data and contrary views and to ask questions and to argue with the agency panel about the propriety or wisdom of a particular rule, and so that there's a real iterative process, again, beginning with the proof that the agency lays out at the beginning and the opportunity for public comment and public hearing a little bit later. Key features of the SONAR. What is in this statement of need and reasonableness? Who will be affected? The cost to the agencies? Whether there's other less intrusive methods of going about the same goal? Whether there are other methods other than rulemaking and achieving the objective? What are the costs of compliance if you're a party that's regulated by one of these rules? The probable costs or consequences if we do nothing at all? And any differences that there might be between the state rule that's offered and any federal requirements. Again, there are rulemaking hearings. The statement of need and reasonableness is presented at a hearing. There's exhibits, there's oral evidence. People can ask questions and provide their own evidence and testimony in this process. What are the benefits of the two systems? So I've got two pictures here. I'll ask particularly the lawyers in the group, and I know that Representative Winkler is one. There may well be others. I don't want to leave anybody out. Can anybody recognize the two courthouses? The first one's easy, right? You've seen Courthouse A.
Across the street.
Right across the street at a prize for Representative Winkler. And the second one is a little harder. It's the E. Barrett Prettyman Courthouse in Washington, D.C. It's on Constitution Avenue. That's where the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit is. It's right down the drive from the Capitol, which would be to the right in this particular picture. And what I wanted to suggest here is that there are two very different litigation models that follow. Again, answering the question of why is the Chapter 14 process so complex? Well, if you look at the case law that comes out of the state courts in Courthouse A, there are probably, and again, I don't want to be exactly quoted out of this, but there are probably 6 to 12 reported decisions in the area of rulemaking in the state case law. I stopped counting at 500 reported decisions from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Now, in the Federal Administrative Procedures Act, they obviously have a wider swath. The federal government is a lot larger than ours, but the quantum leap in the amount of litigation that we have here at the state, a handful of cases as opposed to several hundred or 1,000, suggests, I think, that when you have the kind of process of having the agency prove up in the first instance the propriety of its rule, and then having, before the rule is promulgated, an independent body, namely the Office of Administrative Hearings, make an assessment about that reasonableness. They're not just taking the agency's word for it. You take a lot of the litigation out of the system. In the federal system, the agency has to receive comments, but it has a much wider swath of discretion given to it before taking rules, and I think it does indeed inspire lots of costs and litigation later in the process. And so I think that we have a more regulated party friendly system here at the state, again, because we go through all of the process of vigorous public comment, a level playing field as far as those comments, an independent review, I think political accountability through the gubernatorial veto that makes rulemaking a much better process, even if it is more complicated here in the state than it is at the federal government. So again, the quick recap, I hope I've suggested that rulemaking is an effective part of self-government. It allows the legislature to focus on very big issues and delegate technical issues to this process, which can be trustworthy because it does involve the public. That the key feature for members to focus on, particularly of this committee more than any other, is that what you delegate to a state agency really matters. The words that you use in the legislation that you pass and the pieces of bills that you'll be reviewing really do matter, because those are the instructions to the agency. If they're very broad, you're going to give a wide range of opportunities for the agencies to maneuver. If they're very narrow and specific, obviously they're going to be held to account to operating within a smaller timeframe. And the Office of Administrative Hearings will enforce whatever boundaries this legislature deems fit to set. Go off and do good things, or do it in precisely this way. And that's the choice, principally, that the legislature will be relying upon this committee to set as far as its policymaking rule. When rulemaking, we rely upon the wisdom of the group. We assume that not just the people inside the agency who are drafting know the best result, and we require them to go to the public and prove it up and to hear from the public. Lastly, while it is fairly complicated, what we require folks to do in Chapter 14 and 1400, I think that the results, as far as at least litigation avoidance, but also I think the efficacy of the rules that we produce, speak for themselves, and it's a very good result that this committee justifiably can take pride in. And I hope I just hit it.
Thank you, Judge Lipman. I think he leaves us with some wise words there, that what we do in the form of requesting agencies for rulemaking is extremely important, because they're going to do what we ask them to do, and Judge Lipman's going to make sure they do what we ask them to do. So I think it's very mindful that we think about those things. Judge Lipman, just being new to this committee, when did the Administrative Procedures Act first pass, and how did the state handle these functions before that?
In September, we celebrated our 35th anniversary.
Wow.
And so we had a little cake, the founding of our office and the passage of the Administrative Procedures Act. And I think that there's probably a few folks still around from that session, and likewise still remain on staff who are there at the founding. We had some of them come and speak at an event that we had this past autumn, but it's 35 years almost to the day.
Wow, that's wonderful. Representative Beard has a question.
Madam Chair, I just wanted, can we entertain a couple questions or maybe further?
We do have time to take a few questions, Representative Beard.
Mr. Lipman, I'm thinking about the ability, or maybe it's the propriety of legislators being involved in the rulemaking process, thinking about agencies of which I don't sit on any committees, had any oversight, but might be doing something that I'm interested in. I'll just use myself for an example. How does a legislator show up, be notified, first of all, that something's coming down, have something to say about it, should they have something to say about it? And then I have a follow-up, if perhaps.
Judge Lipman?
Madam Chair, Chairman Beard, I think the short answer is that legislators very well participate in rulemaking process, and in my view, should. There are a couple of things that are part of the process that are baked in so that we get legislative participation. Namely, that the leads of the particular committees and the chairs, particularly if you're a new lead or a new chair, you'll be receiving lots of notices from agencies that matters that are within the purview of this committee will be the subject of rulemaking, and you'll get a notice. Fran Bradley, a couple of years ago, also put into legislation that those notices be written in plain English so that citizen legislators could get the most out of those notices that rulemaking was ongoing. But that's to give you an opportunity, either formally as part of a committee to take a policy-making role, or individually as knowledgeable legislators. And I think the system assumes that because of your studies on particular matters of public concern, that you have a lot to contribute to this process. I would encourage folks that if there are policy areas and matters of administrative rules, that like other members of the public, actually enroll with a state agency, say, I'd like to be on your rulemaking list. Each agency that promulgates administrative rules is required to maintain such a list of folks who want to receive them. And the notices can be either by first-class mail or by email. So from your BlackBerry, you can get a notice that the Department of Health is promulgating rules on TCE standards or the Well Baby program or whatever it is that you might be interested in. Find the administrative agency that regulates in that area and say, I'd like you to keep in touch. And again, with the email notification, if you're not interested in the subject, it's a quick delete key. If you are interested in the subject, you can certainly participate. And there have been occasions, I'm certainly aware of a few, I was involved in some when I was a member, where legislators were part of the group petitioning for a hearing. You know, you may well see a petition go around, we'd like to get 25 or 100, depending upon the nature of the rulemaking, folks to sign up, because we actually want to go and participate in the iterative discussion with the agency panel. And so I think that there's an important role, because you are thought leaders and subject matter experts in a lot of different areas because of your time here at the legislature. I would, as strongly as I could, urge members to enroll in rulemaking lists and to participate in this process. You would contribute to our record as we go through the rulemaking process, and I think you could make a real substantive difference apart from being part of a legislative majority.
Thank you, Judge Lipman. Do you have a follow-up question, Representative Beard?
Madam Chair, I think that may suffice. At some point, though, I'd maybe like to hear someone discuss the Florida model. I was privileged. I just happened to be in Tallahassee when they convened their legislature, and, of course, they did their 10 veto overrides, one of which was nearly unanimous support bipartisanly to override the agency rulemaking callback provision, I guess, for want of a better word. And I don't know what's different about the old Florida model that it sounds like we've maybe got ours wired a little better, but there they gave themselves permission for any group of legislators to attach a rule that's being proposed to stop the rule from happening and make it come back the next legislative session in a statutory fashion or in bill form. I'm not, there's part of that that intrigues me, but part of it that says, whoa, we could really gum up the works if we did that, but I'm not sure that that would be actually helpful. I don't understand all the Florida model. I just got the stuff this week to read the background on it.
Well, I think, Madam Chair, Chairman Beard, I think some of the procedural protections that we have in place mimic those that you're describing. Plus, I would remind members that that you can, by rider language, oblige, and I've seen this done in a number of the chapters in the chapter law, oblige an agency to adopt a rule along a certain line, if they've gone in one direction and you really want them to go in another, or you can always revise the delegation of authority or repeal a rule. Okay. You know, Part 1400, you know, 6100 is repealed, and the agency should do it this way. These are not unfamiliar legislative responses that are clearly open to you because the delegation comes from you.
Thank you for the tip. Thank you.
Any other questions from members? Thank you, Chair Lipman. Or excuse me, I keep wanting to call you Chair. See, when I used to be a staff here when you were in the legislature.
Well, thank you kindly, Madam Chair. I'm grateful for members' time and attention. It's been great fun, and I hope you'll keep in touch.
Thank you, Judge. I think next we'll move on to introductions now that we have more members here. Perhaps if staff and members could introduce yourself, just briefly introduce yourself, and for members, just let us know what district you represent. We'll start with Luke.
Do you first want to call the meeting to officially order?
Oh, now that we have a quorum. We do have a quorum, so I'll officially call the meeting to order.
Gordon Poole of DFL Research.
Mike Beard from Shakopee Prior Lake, known as District 35A, starting my fifth term in the legislature.
Dave Hancock from District 2B, which is Park Rapids and North, starting my first term.
Dean Erdahl, 18B, which is Meeker County and six townships of western Wright County, and this is my fifth term.
Tim Sanders, Blaine, which is in House District 51A.
Dwayne Quam, 29A. I serve the people of Dodge and part of Olmsted County.
Deb Dyson from House Research.
Roy Coe, Committee Administrator.
Thank you. Joyce Pepin from House District 32A.
Ryan Hamilton, Committee Legislative Assistant.
I'm Rich Murray. I represent 27A, which is Freeborn County and nine precincts in Maurer County.
I'm Michael Nelson. I represent 46A, which is the southern half of Brooklyn Park.
Ryan Winkler. I represent District 44B, which is Golden Valley and St. Louis Park.
I'm Marion Green. I represent 60A in Minneapolis.
And I'm Carol McFarland. I'm starting my third term representing 53B, White Bear Township in North Oaks. Bev Scalzi, District 54B. This is my fourth term I'm beginning, and I've spent every term on a local government committee, so I'm happy to be here. And I represent Little Canada, Vadnais Heights, Southern Shoreview, Eastern Roseville, and Jim Lake.
Hi, good morning, Madam Chair, members. I'm Frank Hornstein from District 60B, representing neighborhoods in the southwest part of the city of Minneapolis. And I'm starting my fifth term.
Hi, Steve Simon, starting my fourth term. I represent St. Louis Park and Hopkins, and I have been on the election-related committee every term.
Margaret Martine, Republican House Research.
And then I'm sorry. You're freshman. I'm sorry, I overlooked you.
Boy, Madam Chair, I was almost going to fall on the sword and beg for forgiveness of being late for the meeting, but I apologize. I was unavoidably detained. Tim O'Driscoll, District 14A, Sartell, Sauk Rapids, and Rice, and Holdingford, and a host of townships in the Stearns County, Benton County area of the state of Minnesota.
Okay, and then we also have Matt Gehring on staff. He's over here, yep, and Mark Shepard, who will be introducing himself. Matt will be doing elections, I believe. And Mark will give a little presentation shortly. And then our two pages, Luke and Katie, would you like to introduce yourselves and say a little bit about where you, what you're doing? School, whatnot?
Third-year page.
That's it. That's cool. The economy. Well, thank you, and especially to staff, especially the pages. And pages are so important to our committee because they take care of every need that we have, and we really appreciate you and look forward to working with you. Okay. We're going to have a presentation from House Research now, and Deb Dyson's going to to start. So please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Deb Dyson. I'm legislative analyst from House Research, which is the nonpartisan legal and research office for the entire House and its members and committees. I'm here today with colleagues from House Research, Matt Gehring and Mark Shepard, who will be both will be speaking shortly. The chair asked us to provide a brief overview of the committee's jurisdiction, and want to tell you we welcome any questions either now or at any time after committee or before committee, or just, you know, whenever you want to talk with us. We're always available. But also, I also want to just to acknowledge that you've probably noticed that in this committee and other committees, you'll see more than one House research analyst. And basically, this is because in order to provide expertise in a subject area, it involves working in a subject area over time, and that generally corresponds with committee structures, but not necessarily every time. The committee structures and the jurisdiction of committees changes with bienniums, but we stay with the subject area in order to develop that expertise for the members. Anyway, different analysts will show up at different times depending on the topic in a committee, but we stick with our subject areas. The committee jurisdiction in general, this committee would be responsible for legislation relating to local, metropolitan, and state government operations and elections. The exact jurisdiction changes with every biennium depending on the referral of bills by the speaker, and the examples that we're giving today are based on past experience, recognizing that some things may change. I covered the local and metropolitan government aspect of the legislation in this committee, and that's the powers, duties, and structure and governance of local and metro government. In other words, not the taxes or state aids related to those. Metropolitan government topics in the past have included various changes to the Met Council's governance, bills to abolish the Met Council, bills to make the Met Council elected, bills to study the Metropolitan Council, and sometimes smaller aspects of metropolitan government, not smaller in substance necessarily, but in scope. Last year there was a bill that related to sewer rates and modifying those that are given in statute. Other metropolitan agencies would include the Metropolitan Airports Commission, which owns and operates the International Airport and six regional airports. Legislation in the past relating to the Airports Commission, at one point there was legislation looking at moving the airport or expanding the existing one, legislation relating to noise from the airport. Metropolitan Sports Facilities Commission is another metropolitan agency established in statute that owns and operates the Metrodome, and legislation relating to professional sports facilities typically comes before this committee. And last session, there was a hearing in May on a Vikings stadium proposal. On the local government side, topics include planning and zoning. Today you have a bill scheduled that relates to variances. Other local government legislation might include local mandate reform, open meeting law, municipal boundary adjustments, which includes incorporation of municipalities, annexation and detachments, eminent domain, proposals relating to county offices, auditor, treasurer, recorder, whether they should be appointed or elected. Sometimes it's a general law change proposed. Sometimes it's individual counties. Uniform municipal contracting law, special districts, sanitary sewer district governance, powers and duties. And then also local government, local laws for individual units of government. And with that, I wanted to highlight two underlying legal principles that go with local and metro legislation. The first one I wanted to mention is that this concept of state and local relationships, local governments are creatures of the legislature, of the state. They have the powers granted to them by the state, and any powers that are necessarily implied from an express grant of power. A common question that comes up in this committee from time each biennium at some point where somebody says, looks at a bill and says, why do we need to hear this? Why can't they just do it? And that gets back to this concept of local governments are creatures of the legislature. They have the powers we give them from the state to the local level. It's always a good question to ask. Sometimes they already have the authority, or it's something that is implied. So it's a good question, but there is a reason why you will see a lot of legislation authorizing local governments to act. There are two provisions in law that mitigate the severity of that principle, and one is home rule charter authority. Both the state constitution and then state statute authorize cities to adopt what is essentially a local constitution, a home rule charter. And of the 854 cities, 107 of them are home rule charter cities, and it's not based on the size of the city. It's a local decision. The other mitigating principle or provision in law is that cities and towns are authorized to provide for the general welfare. There are a lot of powers that are specifically authorized to local governments, and then there's sort of a catch-all provision. They're authorized to provide for the general health and safety and welfare of the community, and that is often a basis of local ordinances. The second item I wanted to mention is the state constitutional limitation on special legislation. And special legislation is legislation that applies to a particular person or place, and that's part of a class. If the law is applying to a class, it's not special legislation. And a class is when the law applies uniformly to all who are similarly situated, and the distinction between this class and that is not an arbitrary or but is genuine and substantial. And there's some case law that talks about that. The most common classification that you would see in this committee has to do with classification of cities, and that is based on population in statute, and there are four classifications. You've probably heard the terms first-class cities, second-class. Well, we have three first-class cities at the moment. Once this 2010 census is certified, Rochester will be joining first-class cities. It's now over 100,000 population. One of the things that you will see in legislation relating to local government, especially when it's a special law for an individual unit of government, which is authorized in the Constitution, is the local approval provision, and it's will often read, this law takes effect the day following compliance with Minnesota Statute 645.021. That's a local approval statute that spells out what the local unit of government has to do to approve that law. There are some exceptions to the need for local approval. One is if the law is permissive, you're granting authority, you wouldn't need to have a local approval. One is if the unit of government affected has over 1 million population, and that was originally enacted for the creation of the Metropolitan Council so that you didn't have to get local approval telling the council what to do. But it now applies to Hennepin County, which has over 1 million population. And then the third is bringing the special law or the unit of government into compliance with general law by, for example, repealing a special law. Matt will be talking a little bit more about what's available, but I just wanted to highlight these two things that I mentioned. We do have publications that go into greater detail about these principles along with lots of other materials. And again, if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. But then next, I think Mark was going to pick up with government, state government.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Just a question I have, looking at this list of jurisdictions, and maybe Ms. Dyson can help me with this, but I've been told in the past this committee has had has heard all the constitutional amendments as they go forward, and it's not on here. Is that something that's been changed in the current administration, or do you know? That's it, Madam Chair.
You're asking me?
Yeah. Do you?
I'm asking to see if I have the jurisdiction list, and then do we put in the packet? I'll have to check on exactly what I. As you know, I wasn't on the committee in the past. The jurisdictional list I've been informed is in the packet.
Yeah, that's the one that you passed out.
Yeah.
And constitutional amendments aren't on there, and I've been informed, like I said, in the past, although constitutional amendments have come to this committee, and as Ms. Dyson said, sometimes that changes, jurisdictions changes from session to session, and I was just wondering if that's something that's changed, if you know where those will be going, seeing as how there was one introduced yesterday and that is not, that didn't come here, so.
Yeah, I'll have to check on that, Representative Nelson, unless staff knows differently. I have not. I only have the jurisdictional list that's in front of us, so.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
No?
Can I speak to that?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
This is for Ms. Dyson. I just wonder, it says here Metropolitan Government, and you talked about the Metropolitan Council, but I wonder about the Metropolitan Sports Facilities Commission, if that falls under this jurisdiction as well.
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, as a metropolitan agency, yes, it would. And it is, as I mentioned, it's the owner and operator of the Metrodome, and in the past, bills that have related to professional sports facilities because of that relationship with the Sports Facilities Commission have come in front of the committee. I always want to qualify whatever I talk, whenever I try to speak as to the jurisdiction of the committee. It really is a decision of the members and leadership. It's so I'm more speaking to how it has happened in the past, but it is a metropolitan agency. Yes.
Is that your question, Representative McClure? Any other questions for Ms. Dyson? All right, Mr. Shepard, will you be going next?
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I'm Mark Shepard, also from the House Research Department, and I work with this committee on issues relating to state government. So if you have questions or drafting requests or information requests relating to those issues, please come see me up on the sixth floor or send me an email or give me a call. I'll talk a little bit about the issues that traditionally have been within the jurisdiction of the Committee on State Government. The committee is somewhat unusual for a policy committee in that there is actually a House rule that requires some bills to be referred here. As Judge Lipman mentioned earlier, the House rules require that any bill that delegates rulemaking authority to a state agency or that exempts a state agency from rulemaking authority be referred here either initially or re-referred from another committee before the bill is heard on the House floor. And House Rule 4.13 also has a similar requirement for bills that substantially change the structure of state agencies or that substantially add or subtract powers from a state agency. So particularly as the session wears on, it's been customary for the Governmental Operations Committees to hear a number of bills that are re-referred from another committee for which the rulemaking or the state agency structure issue is sort of a smaller ancillary issue to the major policy issue of the bill. So you all may be hearing a number of bills that are re-referred to the committee from other committees later in the session, and the subject matter of those bills can be quite varied, spanning all of state government, so it can be interesting learning opportunity and always some new issues in front of you. There are exceptions to that rule for the omnibus finance bills. Traditionally, if omnibus finance bills have rulemaking or change the structure of state agencies, that it's not required that it be re-referred to the Governmental Operations Committee. The other kind of state government issues that the committee has traditionally heard kind of span all of the administrative functions of state agencies. For example, the committee has heard bills dealing with state contracts. In recent years, last year and the year before, for example, the committee heard legislation that provided a new preference in state contracting to veterans-owned businesses. They also heard a bill that was enacted that required information on state contracts and state expenditures generally to be published on the state website. So those are some examples in the state contracting area. The committee also traditionally has had jurisdiction over bills relating to state employment. Yesterday, for example, House File 4, which dealt with a wage freeze on state employees, House File 5, dealing with the size of the state workforce, were both referred to this committee for consideration. Bills that relate to the process of state budgeting and state accounting often have come here, not the budgets themselves, which are the jurisdiction of some of the finance committees, but the process. An example, yesterday, House File 2, which established, proposed a new process for priority-based budgeting, was referred to this committee. The committee has also heard legislation in the past on topics such as internal controls in state government, some of the bills last year dealing with unallotment, and some of the information that's presented as part of the state budget. Those bills tend to start in this committee as the policy committee, and then if the committee recommends them to pass, they typically are referred to the State Government Finance Committee for further consideration. The committee's also had jurisdiction over bills relating to the legislature, things like the number of legislatures, number of legislators, and terms for legislators, bills dealing with special sessions. And finally, in recent years, the committee has dealt with a number of bills that I would say deal with topics government reform generally. Last year, for example, the committee heard and recommended to pass a bill that created a commission on service innovation that has recently issued a report of its findings so far. So, Madam Chair, with that, I'll conclude. It's a wide range of policy issues that relate to the operation of state government, and if any of the members have questions now or later, I would be happy to try to address them.
Thank you, Mr. Shepherd. Does anybody have a question? Okay, we'll move on to Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, members, unlike the Mark and Deb's presentations, my subject to present to you is one that I know that you all know a lot about, even if you haven't served on this committee before, that's elections. So my comments will be fairly brief. The scope of election law, and so as a result, the scope of potential bills that could come before this committee include campaign finance regulation, election administration proposals, and Fair Campaign Practices Act. You can find the campaign finance laws in Chapter 10A and 211A. Election administration is kind of in the 200s, like 200 to 212 in statute, and Fair Campaign Practices is in Chapter 211B. So if you have an idea about election law or in the past how election bills come before this committee, well, there's sort of two primary sources of proposals. The biggest source is sort of your own experiences and the committee's decisions about what it wants to pursue or what it doesn't want to pursue. So based on experiences in recent elections, if you're comfortable that the election machinery in the state is working well, you don't have to take up any election bills. If you have ideas for improving it or making it better, of course, you can propose anything you want to, and it would come before this committee within its jurisdiction for election proposals. In addition to sort of your own experiences and constituent experiences and sort of your own interests in improving Minnesota's election process, there are some federal laws that do govern the way elections run in Minnesota. Most federal laws actually just cover federal elections, so elections for candidates for Congress or U.S. Senate or President. But because state elections run sort of parallel or simultaneously with federal elections, those federal requirements sort of are a nudge to the state to sort of conform its state elections to the federal requirements. Some of the big federal acts that govern elections include the Voting Rights Act from 1965, the Help America Vote Act from 2002 is a federal bill that basically regulates accessibility and voting technology. The Help America Vote Act does include some federal funding for the state, and there's an account on the state budget dealing with funds specifically for election equipment in Minnesota. The Uniform Overseas Citizens and Absentee Voting Act, also known as UOCAVA, is a major piece of federal legislation that governs absentee voting, particularly for members of the military and people who are serving overseas. Last year, you may remember that a bill was enacted that changed the date of the state primary from September to August, and this was largely in response to a new federal requirement under the UOCAVA Act that requires states to allow 45 days for absentee voting for people who are overseas in federal elections. And so the state primary change was actually sort of an ancillary change that was included in that bill to conform the state's absentee voting period to the new federal requirements. I'm not specifically mentioning any federal campaign finance laws, just because mostly federal campaign finance law is different from state campaign finance law, and so most of the federal requirements that would be of interest to this committee deal specifically with election administration. And so that's kind of it. I'll sort of second what Mark had to say. If you have questions or have particular interests or bills that you'd like to pursue related to elections or campaign finance, feel free to give me a call or let me know. I'm happy to help in any way that I can. And the final piece of our presentation today, we just wanted to sort of give you a walkthrough of the House Research Department website, particularly for this committee. There may be some information on there that is useful to understanding some of the topics Deb was mentioning and some of the things that Mark mentioned as well in his presentation. So I hope you can see sort of on the TV the House webpage. I know the font is kind of small. In your packets, there should be a printout and hard copy of some lists of publications that we have on our website, so that might be useful to you as well. But I'll try to talk through what I'm showing on the screen in case you can't see it. So to get to the House Research webpage, you just need to follow the House Offices tab, which is on the main House of Representatives webpage. Click on House Research. And you'll see when you first open the department's webpage, we have our mission statement at the top and then a link to some bill summaries. One of the things that we'll provide for you during committee is nonpartisan summaries of bills that are on the committee's agenda. You'll get them in hard copy in your packets, but you'll also be able to pull them up electronically on this page if you're interested in seeing them. They'll also be linked to the bill status page. If you've sort of perused the main legislative website, you'll find the bill status page, which has a link to our House Research summaries as well. Particularly more of interest to this committee, we have a second tab here called Browse Issues. And this is a page where we have all of our subject areas. As Deb mentioned, we're all assigned to particular topics, and we work primarily within those topics. And on this webpage, you can find all of our publications on any given topic. So, for example, if you're interested in learning more about state government, you can click on the government/state link, and you can find all the publications that Mark had mentioned related to state agencies, government access, state agency operations. And then within this page, if you click on any of these links, for example, this link on rulemaking and review of adopted rules, it'll pull up a short subject publication or a longer publication, depending on the topic, that can help you sort of better understand that issue. Like I said, there are topic pages for each topic that may be of interest, but there's also a local and metropolitan government page. Deb was specifically talking about state and local relations, and she has a number of publications here that sort of explain further the content that she was discussing in her presentation today. And finally, there's also for this committee an elections page and a number of publications there that might be helpful as well, including some sort of background materials on particular topics related to elections, some flow charts that illustrate how sort of the election machinery works in Minnesota, and some other information that may be of interest. And the last tab on our House Research page is a data tab called Get Data. And this is something that we hope is useful to you either in this committee or in your other work as well. And this is a tab that allows you to look up specific items of data that might apply to particularly to local units of government or to that have some sort of number attached to them. So, for example, there's a lookup tool that allows you to find out how much local government aid a particular jurisdiction is receiving. By clicking on that tab, it'll bring you to this page where you can select a particular city. So, for example, we're going to look up local government aid for the city of Aiken, and we'll look at local government aid from 2009 and 2010. It'll show you the exact dollar amount that was paid and certified to that city in the years that you requested. So this might be something that there are a number of other data lookup tools similar to this on our webpage as well, we're hopeful that this will be useful to you sort of as you go through the process and get questions that may relate to specific jurisdictions or specific cities. So that's it. Madam Chair, if there are questions from members, either Deb or Mark or I will be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Does anybody have any questions on elections for Mr. Gehring? Okay, then we'll just a couple of housekeeping notes, and then we're going to go on to House File 52, and I'm going to turn the gavel over to Representative Nelson in a second here. I do want to direct your attention to the rules. I want to make particular attention to Rule Number 4 and 12. As far as amendments, I'm sorry, they haven't been passed out yet. I'll just wait a second here. But the first one has to do with amendments. And I would like to get amendments for the staff to be able to have time to make copies and review and whatnot by noon the day before a bill, if at all possible. I'm not planning to be difficult or unwilling to work with any member on the amendments, however, and if it's just a technical change, we would just ask that we would follow it up with a hard copy so that we do have it for our records and make sure we're able to implement any changes. And then the other note would be just please try to remember that your cell phones create a lot of static, and we've been told that is really wreaking havoc on our sound system here, so if you could try to bear that in mind, that would be helpful. I also want to point out that we will not be meeting again this week. Our next meeting will be next Tuesday. So does anybody have any questions on that before we move on to our Representative Simon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question that I've had for all committee chairs is, do you anticipate a particular time in advance by which you'll let all of us and the public know what bills are up? Because if we have an amendment requirement noon the day before, it would be nice to set that back maybe another day. I don't know what your anticipated practice is about notice.
Well, obviously things move fast towards the end of session, as you know, but my intention would be to give as much transparency as possible, and that would include posting bills as soon as we know, we have time. And so my community administrator is telling me that mostly Thursday evening for the following Tuesday, we'd try to have it posted, for example. So we'll try to work with you on that. Any other questions on? Okay. I will then turn the gavel over to Representative Nelson, and we'll hear House File 52.
And I've been told this is going to be an informational hearing. We won't be taking a vote on this today. Is that correct, Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I do intend to take a vote at some point. However, we had a few more people that had some concerns with the bill, and so I want to have the parties have an opportunity to work them out. However, the docket is going to load up pretty quickly here, so I wanted to get some of the testimony out of the way. And my preference would be to go over the bill, and then if people have concerns, I know we have at least one individual who would like to talk about some of the concerns with the bill, and then we'll hold off and for a vote maybe next week, potentially, or sometime near after.
Representative Beard, you had a question?
Mr. Chair, and perhaps for the author of the bill, which version are we working from? It appears that they don't line up perfectly. They both say House File 52 with the same revisor number on them. But
I believe the correct one was the one that was passed out, and I think I think one of them has a 1 on the bottom and one of them doesn't.
Oh, okay. So use the one with the page numbers?
If you use the one with the page number, there was some...
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
...some error.
Well, Madam Chair, welcome to your committee and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 52 has to do with a Minnesota Supreme Court decision that was... ruled on last summer, the Krementmacher versus City of Minnetonka case. I don't know if many of you had heard from any of your cities on this issue. I did get a call from a couple of Planning Commission members with concern of the court decision. And essentially, the decision made it difficult since last July for cities to approve variances from their zoning codes for projects. And the decision really, in my mind, and I think in a lot of other people's mind, overturned a long-standing precedent. And it created a situation that put cities and land use applicants in a position where a variance can only be approved where there is no other reasonable use of the applicant's land. So I have with me Tom Grundhofer, the General Counsel for the League of Cities, to describe the bill in a little bit more detail.
Thank you. Mr. Grundhofer, please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Grundhofer, General Counsel with the League of Minnesota Cities. On behalf of the League and on behalf of a broad coalition of public and private interests, we'd like to first thank Representative Pepin and the members of the committee for hearing this bill so expeditiously. As indicated by Representative Pepin, the legislation is in direct response to a Supreme Court decision this past summer entitled Krumenacher versus City of Minnetonka. It got a lot of play in the press and has gotten a lot of reactions from a lot of different groups.
For those of you who are not familiar with variances, what they are is a tool that local governments have to basically allow landowners to deviate from the strict interpretation or application of a zoning code. For instance, a city may have in their zoning code a, this is just an example, a side yard setback requirement of 10 feet. So structures have to be set back 10 feet from the side yard. A property owner, because of situations or circumstances unique to their property, may seek or want to, for instance, build a deck, an addition, a garage that might encroach somewhat into that side yard setback requirement. And the way the law has traditionally been interpreted for some 20 years since a decision titled Roel back by the Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals and frankly the Supreme Court has afforded a fair amount of latitude to local governments to grant variances from those strict interpretations of their zoning provisions. Unfortunately, this past summer, the Krumenacher decision really reversed what has been 20 years of law on the subject and basically said that a local government could not grant a variance to a landowner except where the landowner could show that they had no reasonable use of the property without the variance. What effectively that did was, in essence, prohibit local governments from issuing variances except in very, very rare circumstances. It's important to note that we're really not trying to go against what the Supreme Court said. The Supreme Court didn't really say that they disagreed with the public policy behind giving local governments broad authority, but they said they felt constrained by the wording of the particular statute in Minnesota Statute 462. Let me just quote a couple of comments from the decision. They said, had the Minnesota legislature not defined undue hardship as it did, we might consider a more flexible variance standard. The court goes on to say, we recognize that the reasonable manner standard represents a long-standing interpretation and that Minnesota municipalities have granted variances under that reasonable manner standard for many years. But whatever value we may find in a more flexible standard, we could not ignore the plain language of the statute. Finally, the court says, unless and until the legislature takes action to provide a more flexible standard for municipalities, we are constrained by the language of the statute. So what we're really trying to do is fix the language of the statute. The proposed language you have before you, I'll describe as four substantive things. First, it puts back where it was puts back the variance law to where it was prior to the Krumenacher decision by eliminating what is termed the undue hardship standard and the requirement that a property owner must show that they have no reasonable use of their property before a variance can be granted. So it sort of, well, not sort of, it deletes the language that the Supreme Court relied on for rendering its decision the way it did. Secondly, what it does is it introduces the concept of a reasonable manner. What traditionally has been the law in Minnesota for the past 20 years is that somebody could get a variance if the property owner could show that the proposed use of the property is being purported in a reasonable manner, that the plight of the landowner is due to circumstances unique to the property, not created by the landowner, and the variance, if granted, will not alter the essential character of the locality. So what we're trying to do basically in this law and the wording is codify what has traditionally been the language from the Court of Appeals over the last 20 years. Thirdly, and probably very significantly, the legislation creates a single standard for variances for counties, cities, and townships. You'll notice that the proposed language amends not only the county variance standard, but also the city variance standard. Historically, there's been some slight differences in wording, and the courts have applied slightly different interpretations based on that differences in wording. from the folks that we've talked to, we see no particular reason why there's a different standard for county variances and a different standard for city variances, so we've tried to follow the same kind of language and lay that out for both cities, counties, and townships. Fourth, the bill tries to explicitly provide authority to impose conditions on variances in order to mitigate the effects on neighboring landowners. The decision Krumenacker versus City of Minnetonka is actually a lawsuit that was brought by a neighbor to the person who was seeking the variance. So one of the things we want to be cognizant is the desire to allow cities to impose conditions to mitigate the effects on some of those neighboring property owners, and that's language in the statute. As indicated, and I don't know if the pages have handed them out, we have provided a letter to the committee that is support that indicates support for this legislation from a wide group of associations and entities, both public and private. I think there's up to 10 to 15 different groups supporting this legislation. We think this is legislation is important for three main reasons. It provides the property owners the potential for greater use of their property than what they have the way in light of the Supreme Court's decision. It really provides work and jobs for the construction industry at a time when they need it the most. And it provides flexibility to local governments to respond to the unique situations they may be encountering in their communities. For these reasons, we really encourage the committee to support this important piece of legislation. And frankly, we think it's very important that it happens earlier than later. We've had calls from contractors, builders, and others basically saying that they are not able to go forward with projects because local governments are unable to grant variances in light of the Supreme Court decision. Every week, every month that goes by where those projects can't go forward are situations where businesses, homeowners, and others can't use their property as they might want to. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for the testifier? Must have done a good job. Are there any... Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Nelson. Actually, I do. On maybe you touched on it, sir, Mr. Grunhofer, on line 2.5, and I'm not a lawyer. I've never even played one once in a high school play, but we struck prohibited and put in not allowed. Is that one of those terms you're talking about where they mean different things to legal people? And I'm curious as to why we struck one, put the other, and what is it that we're getting ourselves into if we approve that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that particular amendment on line 2.5 really wasn't put in to respond to the Supreme Court's decision. It was put in to respond to the, I'll call it the reality of the way zoning ordinances are drafted. More often than not, a zoning ordinance will not describe uses that are prohibited. It will describe uses that are allowed. So I think the way the old law was, frankly, just was not consistent with the way city and county zoning ordinances are drafted.
Any follow-up?
Thank you. Yes, one, if I may. Down a couple lines, we struck the words "the public interest" and put in specific words about public health, safety, and environment. Is that sort of heading in the same direction as the previous explanation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, that's basically consistent with, you know, sort of the broader way that courts have applied municipal authority. They basically say cities can do things in the public health, safety, and environment. The concept of public interest is sort of not a term that's typically used. So it's not meant to be a substantive change, more of a clarification.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions, the members? If not, thank you, Mr. Grunhofer. Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to testify for or against? Again, please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Alyssa Shalander. I represent the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. We are the trade association that represents all of the franchise new car dealers in the state of Minnesota. I just wanted to take a minute just to thank Representative Pepin for her willingness to slow down a bit on this bill. Since the bill was just introduced yesterday, there are a few of us in the business community who really haven't had adequate time to review the bill and get feedback from those that we represent. And I happen to represent an industry with very unique land use needs, as I'm sure you can understand, as our businesses attempt to improve and develop their properties, zoning issues are just exceedingly important as they add time and oftentimes cost to any project. Particularly, we do have just sort of a concern, I'm not sure that I can articulate it today, about some of the language that Representative Beard just highlighted. It seems, just on first blush, to allow the municipality's power to impose new environmental requirements on property owners, which is something that we would just like to have time to discuss with those that represent our businesses in their land use issues. Of course, we do want to say that we recognize the importance of dealing with the variance issue in light of the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in the Krumenacker case, and I think everyone shares that goal. But we would just like to work with Representative Pepin and others in coming days to advance a bill that's really best for businesses that are trying to improve and develop their properties as well as the zoning authorities. So once again, I just want to say thank you for your willingness to allow us a few extra days to try to come up with a bill that that we can all go forward with. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Shalander. Any questions for the testifier? Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Shalander, what would be an example of an environmental concern you have with the bill?
Yeah, Mr. Chair Representative Hornstein, I think that's part of my problem, that I just really haven't had a chance to flesh that out with our members. I mean, again, the bill was just introduced yesterday, and I was not part of the group that drafted the bill. And so that's really part of my concern, is that those are words that just kind of jump off the page to me, and we need a few days to review that, because I don't know if those are, sort of innocuous terms that really do put us back to the world as it was pre-Krumenacker, or if those are really, new things that may or may not make life more difficult for our businesses.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Follow up?
No.
Any further questions? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lander, I noticed in this letter from the League of Cities that there are a lot of business groups that are supporting this version of the bill. Builders, BATSE, Realtors, Shopping Center Association, NIAP, and then the St. Paul and Twin West Chambers. I just wonder if your concerns, are they based on the fact that there's something specific about the auto dealers, or is it just one of process just your familiarity with the language?
Ms. Shalander.
I at this point, the only answer I can give you, Representative Winkler, is that it would be more the latter. But I reserve my right to say that it may be the former.
Yes and no. Representative Winkler.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, that's fair. If you don't have familiarity with it because you haven't been part of the process, then of course you haven't formed a judgment about the substance of it. I guess the thing that I have concern about is, there was extensive investigative stories over the summer about the problems with water quality in northern Minnesota, at least in part attributable to a exuberance of variances in some of the counties up there. And a native of the area, I understand the economic consequences and what some of the pressures might be. And I guess when I look at this bill and see that mitigating requirements can be required as part of the variance, I take a lot of comfort from that. And I guess to the extent that some of those environmental concerns are not addressed in this bill, my own support of the bill, I think, decreases. So I guess my suggestion is that the more we can account for this environmental mitigation in the bill, the more bipartisan the support would probably be.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Winkler. Any further questions? Anybody else in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? If not, we'll hold the bill over for future consideration. And with that, I think the meeting's adjourned. It's adjourned until next Tuesday.